Welcome to another episode of the Revolution Health Radio Show. This show is brought to you by ChrisGresser.com. I'm your host, Steve Wright from SCDLifestyle.com. With me is integrative medical practitioner, New York Times bestseller, and healthy skeptic, Chris Gresser. Chris, how are you feeling today?
I'm great. How are you, Steve?
I'm very grounded today.
Feeling grounded. Good. So. Glad to hear it. That's germane to our topic, so we'll get into that in a second.
Yeah, we almost talked too much before we got going on the show here today. Before we get into that, though, Chris, what did you have for breakfast?
What did I have for breakfast today? Let's see. I had bacon, eggs, and some bok choy cooked in a little bit of coconut oil.
Nice. Sounds very good. It might edge out Jordan's sweet potato fries he made me for breakfast this morning. He came to stay.
I don't know. That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, they're like these shavings. It was like a hash, sweet potato hash. So that was pretty good.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that sounds great.
So we're going to be doing a Q&A episode today. And we're going to start, though, with a little bit of an experiment that you've been undertaking, Chris. And after what Jordan and I kind of put ourselves through the last couple of weeks trying to finish our new product, it's been on my mind. And one of the reasons why I'm feeling grounded today is we just got done doing a hike here in Boulder. And tell me, let's just talk about your experiment.
Yeah, so this is something I do regularly, once a year at least, preferably more. But last year has been pretty intense, so it's been a while since I've done it. And some people call it a digital detox. That's as good a name for it as anything, unplugging completely. But the idea is you take a certain period of time. I recommend a minimum of 5 days if that's possible. I took 10 days this time because I felt like I really needed a good solid break, completely away from technology. And there are a lot of reasons doing this, and I want to talk about a few of them before we get into the details of how to actually do the digital detox, at least how I do it. And I want to start just by asking a few questions. So if everyone listening, and you, Steve, let me know if you resonate with any of these descriptions. Do you often have difficulty sustaining attention in tasks? Do you often not have difficulty listening when someone's speaking to you directly? Do you often have difficulty organizing tasks and activities? Do you often avoid or dislike, or are you often reluctant to engage in tasks that require really sustained mental effort? And are you often easily distracted by extraneous stimuli, like an email coming in or a text message or something like that? Will that often, distract you from what you're doing?
Yes.
So, yes, right? I imagine a lot of people would answer yes to most or even all of those, right? Interesting thing is those are essentially the diagnostic criteria for ADHD.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so I'm not saying this to make any of us feel bad or I'm trying to diagnose you or everybody that's listening with ADHD, but the reality is, according to, as Dr. Edward Hallowell put it, who's a psychiatrist who specializes in treating ADHD, once applicable only to a relative few, the symptoms of ADD now seem to describe just about everybody. And another way to put it is we're living in many ways in a culture, an entire culture that is ADHD. We're subjected to constant distraction, emails coming in, multiple windows open in our browser, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, Pinterest, YouTube videos, news stocks, text messages. I mean, I'm only getting started. There's so many other ways that we can be distracted throughout a day. And all you have to do is think about when the last time is that you went an entire day, for example, without checking email or social media, or how about even an hour? You know, when's the last time you went an hour when you didn't do that? Or when is the last time you took an hour or more, maybe several hours, to just think creatively about something or think long term, you know, really consider what your vision is for yourself, what you'd like to accomplish, or you know, any particular thing that you're thinking about in your life without interruptions.
Well, I was having a hard time on the hike today, not pulling out my cell phone. I was like tracking myself, and like I would have like this unconscious urge to like just pull it out of my pocket. Like it just had, it'd been like 35 minutes. Oh no.
Right. Yeah. And I actually just talked to someone yesterday who they didn't do a full digital detox, but they uninstalled Twitter from their phone. And he said that he was literally like, his hand was like twitching to go, you know, to move to his pocket to take out the phone and look at it to see if there are any tweets. And it was like a physical trained response. And it was just remarkable to him that it really was like dealing with an addiction. And there are a lot of addictive aspects to this kind of technology and media and distraction, because it stimulates reward centers in our brain. Each time we check an email, there's a chance that something good, something there will be there for us, you know, something that reinforces some aspect of who we think we are, you know, gives us a little bit of a reward. Same for Twitter, Facebook, etc. And when anytime those reward centers of the brain are engaged, there's potential for addiction or addictive behavior. And what you just said, Steve, is I think almost universal in terms of the experience that people have when they do the digital detox, or they try to step away from this kind of engagement. It's just really pervasive and insidious, and it affects us in ways that we're often not even conscious of. And you know, some people might say, well, so what? What's the problem with that? The thing is, the ability to control where our attention is directed is really fundamental to optimal performance in just about anything, whether you're talking about writing or, you know, whatever kind of work that you do, or sports, or learning a new hobby, or music, or athletic performance. And it's also really crucial to health and happiness. There are, you know, many wisdom traditions and religions that focus on or have techniques that in some way train attention, like meditation, for example, meditation practice and mindfulness practice, because they recognize that the ability to control our attention rather than just have it be bounced around like a pinball in a machine by any type of distraction that, you know, happens to be present is really crucial for a sense of presence and groundedness and health and happiness. And there are a lot of people now who are writing about what this exposure to constant distraction has done for us and what it might do for us in the future. And I think it's a little bit alarming. We had a podcast a while back on how the internet is rewiring the brain. We talked a lot about some of the research, the nitty-gritty research on this topic, so you can refer to that. I'm not going to go into all the studies this time. But one author, Maggie Jackson, who wrote a book called Distracted, The Erosion of Attention and the Coming of the Dark Age, you can see what she thinks about it just from reading the title. She wrote, the way we live is eroding our capacity for deep, sustained, perceptive attention. And that, I think, is the biggest problem that we're facing right now in this age of constant distraction, is an inability to think deeply about anything, because we're thinking horizontally more and more. We're thinking about a lot of different things, but not very deeply. And we're constantly kind of skimming the surface of attention, and our attention's being pulled in multiple different directions. So we rarely have the opportunity to just, you know, drive vertically, deeply into a particular issue, problem, or a vision that we want to manifest in the world. And that at the end of the day is what I think the most, that's one of the most compelling reasons to do a digital detox or to completely unplug. Many people now, even when they're on vacation, are still, you know, checking social media, taking pictures, uploading them, you know, checking email, doing all this. So it's rare for folks to get a break at all, even on vacation. And I think there are really potentially serious repercussions for that.
Yeah, so what have you noticed, Chris? Is there anything that you were tracking going into it that that you've noticed kind of now on the other end of 10 days of no tech?
In the past, it's been more difficult for me. And I have, you know, noticed this sort of like knee-jerk response to want to get online and, you know, check my email, whatever. This time, to be honest, it was pretty easy. And I think in part it was just because I was so ready for it with the book and the book tour and the lead up to the book launch and all of the work that went into that. I was just really, really ready to just completely disconnect. And the first day, I think, was maybe a little difficult, a little unusual. Noticed my mind wandering and wanting to check my email or tune in. But very quickly for me, I got to the point where I had an active aversion to the idea of doing that. And I was using the phone or computer for very simple things like, if we needed to get directions somewhere. I've been away for a little while taking a break. And so, you know, if we needed to look up directions or check the weather or something like that. But it was limited to, you know, single activities that were related to something that we needed to do in the world right then. And you know, at first, the first day or the second day, when I would go to check the weather, something I might notice, like a desire to also open my email and just check in. I didn't do that. But this after the second day, it was almost the opposite. It was like I didn't even want to open my email because I was I knew that the effect that would have on my mental space. And after the second or third day, I really just started to settle in and I was writing in my journal. I was doing some of these visioning exercises that I sometimes do when I'm at a point in my life or where I feel like I'm thinking about what the next steps are, and I've just been reading a lot, both nonfiction and fiction, meditating a lot, a lot of physical activity and a lot of time just doing nothing. And it's been really extremely therapeutic. This yesterday was my first day back, and I was kind of dreading it. I was dreading opening my email and seeing the hundreds of messages there and dreading, you know, getting back online, because there's a way that I just got really attached to that mental space that I was in.
Nice. Well, thank you for sharing that. And I hope to be able to do that later this year. I can definitely tell. Even, you know, Jordan and I made a conscious effort to unplug this week for a few hikes, and mm-hmm. It was just like, oh wow, this is interesting. I haven't been in this space in a while. This is nice. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and I mean, you don't have to do 10 days to benefit from it, or even 5 days. I mean, one of the commitments I'm going to be making, and that I used to do, that I've fallen out of the habit of it with the book, was to just have 1 day each week where I completely don't even go near the computer or phone or anything, you know, not even, and when I'm at home, I don't really need to get directions or anything like that. So I think 1 day of having no interaction with screens at all is really therapeutic. I did that in the past, and I found it to be really, really helpful. Just 1 day, and I think most people can probably work that in their schedule. And even just having periods during the week, maybe a half day during the week, or a couple of hours during the week, or maybe evenings past a certain time, you cut it off. There are a lot of ways to work in smaller breaks where you're not dialed in. And of course, we did those two podcasts on increasing your productivity. And I talked about things like batching email and social media, where you're not checking them consistently throughout the day. You're just dedicating certain periods of time during the day to check. You turn off the reminder on your phone where, you know, it beeps anytime a new email or social media notification comes in. And so there are lots of different strategies for doing this throughout the week. And I would definitely recommend that, as well as a longer period of digital detox each year, if possible. So a couple details on just how to do it. I mean, it's pretty straightforward, and it obviously depends on your circumstances. But for me, I set up an autoresponder on my email that just said, you know, I'm unplugged and not checking or responding to email during this period. And if you need help with this, you can contact this person. If you need help with that, you can contact that person. In my case, because there's a lot still going on, and I had someone within my company who was checking in on my email every 2 or 3 days and just scanning to make sure there wasn't anything urgent. And he had my phone number and permission to call or text if there was a dire emergency. The sky was falling and I absolutely needed to deal with something, but that didn't happen. Fortunately, I didn't expect it to, and it didn't. And then my rules were no checking email, no social media, no browsing the internet, just kind of getting on the web and looking something up. And then, you know, we all know this, how that works. You know, one thing leads to the next, and it's 45 minutes later and you don't even have any idea what you've been doing. No reading news headlines. I figured, you know, the world would go on without me. No kind of undirected activity online. Some people prefer to just completely unplug and not use screens at all, like no checking weather, no directions, no looking at a restaurant or anything like that, because they just find it's like a slippery slope. You know, as soon as they get on, they're not able to stop it there. And so that's, you know, that's up to you. For me, I think going to that extreme isn't really necessary, because now with the computer and phone are so easy to use to get directions, check weather and that stuff. It's way faster and more efficient than doing it any other way. And as long as you just do it for a minute or two, I don't think it's going to it really interferes with the purpose of the detox, the unplugging. And then I think it's also a good idea to have some ideas for how you're going to spend all that time that you used to spend, you know, checking email and social media and all that stuff. And for me, that, as I said, that was journaling and writing and meditating, take lots of long walks and lots of physical activity. It's a great time to like start learning a new hobby or start doing some new creative activity, brainstorming, hanging out with friends, spending more time with your partner or your kids, and just like you and Jordan were doing, go on a hike. You know, have some things to do that will really engage your senses in a way that you don't typically do.
Perfect. Well, I'm definitely getting in tune with that idea of at least picking an afternoon or a morning. I typically work in the mornings. Like, that's when I got my ability to focus the best. So definitely into unplugging for an afternoon or two every week, starting to have some new rules around that. That sounds pretty delicious for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe we'll do a kind of digital detox challenge at some point. And of course you won't be able to check in and get any help that way. Maybe just knowing that other people are doing it at the same time could be helpful. I don't know.
Good work.
So let's answer a couple of questions. I will say one thing we didn't mention at the beginning of the show is there's probably going to be some changes to the show in the future, just kind of reflecting on what's worked, what hasn't worked, and what future directions to go in. So would be curious to hear from you listeners what it is that you really like about the show, what you'd like to see more of, what you'd like to see less of, because I'm in a period of thinking about this now and would love to get some feedback. So maybe we can create like a little form that you can fill out, and we'll put the link in the show notes on the website, and you can go there and do it that way, or you can submit something on Facebook or fill out the existing podcast question form, whatever is easiest for you. And that way we'll have some your feedback as well.
Yeah, so before we jump into the questions, Chris, so as we kind of switch over our documents here to the questions, I just want to let the listeners know that, in case you haven't heard yet, Chris redid chriskresser.com and basically created this wonderful cocoon of how to get healthy. Over 80,889 people as of today have already signed up for a membership at chriskresser.com. And when you sign up there, what Chris did is he really consolidated a lot of stuff that you might not have known that he has already created. So there's MP3 recordings with experts and all kinds of things from thyroid to gut health. Chris has done a lot of ebooks on gut health and on thyroid and other topics as well. And so he's really kind of, whatever your choice of medium to consume information from Chris, he's created this membership site where you get access to all of this material for free. So in with this membership, you'll also get a 30-part email series on the most essential topics that he's basically isolated out for anyone who's serious about feeling great, eating well, and living that high performance lifestyle that we were just talking about. So this is the call to action right now to go over to chriskresser.com, get your free membership, check out whatever your subject is that Chris writes about that you're following us for. Make sure you've read all the stuff that he's put in there, because he spent a lot of time and effort on that.
All right.
All right, Chris, let's do some Q&A, man.
Okay.
So these questions were pulled from Chris's Facebook feed. So if you're not following Chris on Facebook, go to facebook.com/ChrisKresserLAC and hit like, and then you'll be able to have some input on these last minute shows that we do where we're asking for questions. So these will all be just coming from people on Facebook. And the first one we have here is, Chris, does a high-fat diet cause endotoxemia?
Wow. So this is a really interesting question. First of all, for those of you that don't know, endotoxemia is a condition where there is an increase in endotoxins like lipopolysaccharide, and that can provoke a low-grade inflammation, chronic inflammation, which in turn promotes metabolic disease like diabetes. So there is a lot of research in mice and some in humans that suggests that a very high-fat diet can produce this or contribute to endotoxemia and increase circulating levels of the endotoxin known as lipopolysaccharide, or LPS. And LPS is the primary structural component of the outer membrane of gram-negative bacteria, and LPS only originate in the gut. So this is all gut mediated. And very interesting, though, to look, when you look deeper into this research, and some of the newer studies have actually looked at the contribution of the gut flora here. And what they found was that when levels of bifidobacteria are low, which is a beneficial species of bacteria in the gut, the really high fat diet does contribute to endotoxemia in animals and in humans. But when bifidobacteria levels are normal or, you know, increased, then it doesn't have that effect. The LPS normalizes and you don't get that effect of chronic inflammation. And that's really crucial to understand, because it suggests that a high fat, low fiber diet, because fiber, soluble fiber in particular, and prebiotic fibers are what feed the beneficial bacteria in the gut, the bifidobacteria. If you follow a diet that is really high in fat and really low in those prebiotic fibers, then it is possible that that could cause some problems and some chronic low-grade inflammation. But if the high fat intake is in the context of a diet that is rich in fruits and vegetables and starchy tubers and things that promote the growth of beneficial species of bacteria like bifidobacteria, then there's no evidence that the high fat intake will have this effect. So, I mean, when you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, that makes sense, because we don't really know of cultures that have extreme high fat intakes without eating some significant amount of either fermented products or plants. You know, most traditional cultures that have been studied, hunter-gatherer cultures that have been studied, eat a lot of plants and prebiotic-bearing plants. There are over 36,000 species of plants in the world that contain the carbohydrate fructan, which is a prebiotic, and many of those are tubers, which played a very important role in the early hominin diets in human evolution. As I've argued before, there's a lot of research showing that tubers, along with meat, in part made us human, because they allowed us to, you know, when we came down from the trees and started to eat different foods than ripe fruit, these meat and tubers were foods that made that possible and allowed us to obtain significant number of calories and nutrients so that our brains could continue to get bigger and we could get smarter and, you know, turn into the humans that we are today. So that's one of the reasons why I typically don't recommend really long-term, very low carb, ketogenic, GAPS intro type of diets, unless there's a really specific reason to do them. And even then, it's best to, I think, to accomplish whatever the therapeutic goal is, and then to start adding back in fermentable fibers into your diet as quickly as possible so that you can get the benefits of those fibers, like improving your gut flora, and avoid some of the potential harms of a diet that is not feeding those bacteria. And there's been a lot of discussion about this lately, right? It seems like every time you see, you know, I open up my news feed or social media, I'm seeing studies about the impact of gut flora on various aspects of health, so that this shouldn't be a huge surprise, really.
Yeah, it's finally gaining some steam in the media as well as the science community. There's a lot of people studying it, so it's really cool to see. I like to think now about, you know, fruits and vegetables. I'm feeding the gut bugs, and the mm-hmm. butter that accompanies those fruits and vegetables, that's feeding me.
Yeah, although butter has some butyrate, which is pretty good, important too. Yeah, so it's feeding you, but it's got some nutrients that are produced by the gut bacteria. So butter is kind of a win-win there, right?
True. Awesome. Well, I think we should keep rolling with this kind of carb topic, and this next question really segues into that, Chris. Do FODMAP sensitivities ever go away? If someone has SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and has a FODMAP sensitivity, what kind of carbs can they eat? And do you have to take antibiotics to get rid of SIBO, or can it be fixed through diet?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we've talked about it a few times on the show in various places, but I would say in general, FODMAP sensitivities can be eliminated completely, but in many cases, they're significantly reduced rather than completely eliminated. So what I will often see happen is that people are able to add back in many different FODMAPs that they couldn't tolerate before, but there might be a few FODMAPs that they just still don't do very well with. Onions and garlic tend to be the worst offenders. Or they might be able to tolerate a small amount or moderate amount of all of the FODMAPs. But if they go overboard, if they have a dish that just has tons of onion and garlic, for example, or they eat a really large amount of high fructose of fruit that has more fructose than glucose, then they might have a little bit of discomfort. I would say that's kind of a typical response, although some people do seem to completely lose all sensitivity. I think as fecal transplants become more available and alternative delivery systems become available, like, well, they're kind of affectionately known in the medical world as crapsles. Because that really is probably the future of fecal transplants. It's not practical to do them the way they're done now on a widespread basis. It's just not, you know, it's always going to be more expensive that way and less accessible to people. And so I imagine that people are going to, you know, they're going to figure out an oral delivery system that works. And then when that happens, they'll be much more accessible to people. And when that does happen, we might assume that it would be possible to completely eradicate FODMAP sensitivity, because I think that FODMAP sensitivity is really caused by alterations in the gut microbiota. And we can do a lot with changing our diet and using probiotics and even prebiotics, but in some cases that may not be enough to just have the really profound impact on the gut microbiota that a fecal transplant, or, you know, taking capsules with isolated human bacteria strain or bacteria strains from a healthy human donor would have. So that's the first part. The second part, is it necessary to take antibiotics to get rid of SIBO? I don't think so. Definitely not, because I treat a lot of patients for SIBO in my practice, and I don't use antibiotics. And in fact, I have a lot of patients who come to me having taken multiple courses of rifaximin or neomycin, which are the narrow spectrum, non-absorbable forms of antibiotics that are used to treat SIBO. And while they had generally have initial success from taking antibiotics, what often happens is the SIBO will come back, and it tends to happen more quickly the more times they take the antibiotics. The natural protocol that I tend to use in my clinic takes longer generally to produce the result, but the results tend to be longer lasting. Now, having said that, everybody's different, and some people do very well with the antibiotics and seem to need the antibiotics even if, you know, after taking the natural protocol. But more times than not, I find the natural protocol is more effective.
Yeah, I can't echo what you were saying earlier about the FODMAPs enough. It's very common for us to be working with people, and people on our site have all kinds of FODMAP sensitivities. And I think I definitely want the message out there that they go away. They can go away. And I think some of the people who haven't, what I've seen is some of the people who haven't resolved every single FODMAP is they're kind of new in the entire sort of integrative approach of fixing all of their health related issues. And it seems to take, you know, 12 to 18 months or longer for you to really get the complete resilient health back that might be what you need to be able to handle all the types of FODMAPs. So I think obviously everybody who's sick, including myself, wants to get better tomorrow. And so sometimes I think some people say, well, I'm, you know, I can't do the FODMAPs or I can't do eggs or something. They sort of adopt that as it's just who they are. When the reality is, it just wasn't really time yet for the immune system to have been corrected, for their hormones to be corrected, or whatever the root issue with them is. And so I think people should continue to try those, keep testing them.
Yeah, exactly. And we've talked about this before, but it's a little bit of a tricky thing sometimes to treat these issues, because with FODMAPs, you're avoiding prebiotics. That's what all prebiotics are, FODMAPs. So when you're on a low FODMAP diet, you're avoiding prebiotics. But the thing is, prebiotics are what have the most profound effect on the gut flora over time. So if you always avoid prebiotics and you don't make any effort to work them back into your diet, even at low levels, then you might, you know, feel better for as long as you avoid those foods, but you may never regain your ability to eat those foods, because the changes in the gut microbiota or what led to that inability in the first place. So it's a little bit, I think, where you have a situation where, you know, you need to avoid those at first for symptom relief, and while you're addressing the SIBO with the natural protocol, doing other things to heal your gut, and then you gradually add back in some of those fibers as you can tolerate them, so that increasingly over time you have less sensitivity. And that's the really tricky part.
Yeah. And I think what you said there was key, Chris. It's been my observation that essentially anybody with severe FODMAP sensitivities, or even full FODMAP exclusions of certain classes, they typically have some sort of GI infection. And so just sitting on the FODMAP diet or the GAPS diet or the SCD diet for years is not going to be doing yourself any favors. You need to be working with a qualified functional medicine doc or integrative practitioner who can kind of help guide you through that.
Exactly. Yeah. So we have one more question on this related to this topic. Let's just do that one since it's easy to group in here.
Awesome. Yeah. So let's say you're hopping into this, you're trying to figure out what kind of diet you should eat. You start with getting some more fruits and veggies. You realize you have a FODMAP sensitivity. You realize you have SIBO. You get that treated, Chris. Now all of a sudden, the story changes to, what do I do to rebuild my gut? And specifically this question is, how can you restore your gut flora when you're unable to tolerate probiotics or fermented foods?
Yeah, and he or she adds that's not likely due to histamine intolerance, because histamine intolerance might be one reason that someone couldn't tolerate probiotics or fermented foods. But there's a couple ways to answer this. So I think I've mentioned this before, but back when I was still really sick and starting my recovery process, I could not tolerate probiotics either. But that's not necessarily a reason not to take them. And what I mean by that is that you may just need to start with extremely low doses and build up very slowly over time. Because if your gut microbiota is really screwed up, then you take a full dose of a probiotic. Chances are one of the things that probiotics do, one of the ways that they work, is they upregulate the immune system. They compete for adhesion sites in the gut with less beneficial forms of bacteria. Some probiotics are actually antimicrobial themselves, so they can potentially cause a lot of different, for lack of a better term, detox reactions, things that can make you uncomfortable. And that's a lot of folks try, they buy a probiotic, they take a capsule or the dose that's recommended on the bottle, and they have a terrible reaction. And they just figure, oh, I can't take probiotics. But that's generally, that kind of reaction is often a sign that you really need them more than more than anybody else. And the solution is not necessarily to stop. It's to either reduce the dose dramatically or to switch to different types of probiotics. So if you're taking like lactic acid forms of probiotics like Acidophilus, Bifidobacteria, et cetera, then you might want to switch to soil-based type of probiotic because they tend to be a lot better tolerated with people with SIBO. I've spoken before about how SIBO often involves an overgrowth of lactic acid-forming bacteria, and that type of bacteria is typically found in commercial probiotics and fermented foods. So if you have SIBO and you take those kinds of probiotics or eat those foods, you very well could feel worse. However, there are other types of probiotics like that are made from soil-based organisms that typically won't have that effect. Prescript Assist is one, which I sell on my website because of that. It's probably the best tolerated probiotic that I'm aware of. It works for the greatest number of people and seems to cause the fewest side effects. And it's very effective for constipation, which is not always the case. A lot of probiotics tend to make constipation worse, in large part, I think, because of what the phenomenon I was just talking about, how, if you have SIBO and you take certain kinds of probiotics, it makes it worse. So switching to soil-based organisms and then taking a very, very small dose. So for example, if you get Prescript Assist and you get the capsules, you would actually open the capsule and just pour out like a quarter of a capsule on top of some food. It's heat stable. Soil-based organisms don't need to be refrigerated. You don't have to worry about that as much. So you can just put it on a little bit of food and eat it that way. And then you just increase very, very gradually as your symptoms dictate. You know, it could be like you might be on a quarter of a capsule for 2 weeks before you can go up to half a capsule, et cetera. So for me, when I was doing it, I had to be extremely methodical, and it took months until I could tolerate, you know, a substantial amount of probiotics and fermented foods. I remember I started with kefir. I started with like a half a teaspoon a day, which is so such a small amount, it seems almost not worth doing. But if I did any more than that, I would have a reaction. And then after about nine or 10 months of doing that, I could tolerate a full glass of kefir without any problems, and my gut was a lot better. So that's one answer. The second answer relates to what we were just talking about in terms of prebiotics and fermentable fibers. All of the research now suggests that it's really prebiotics and fermentable fiber that has the most profound impact on the gut flora, on the quantity and composition of the gut flora over time. Probiotics have a number of beneficial effects, like regulating the immune system, promoting T regulatory cell development, improving our immunity, helping fight infection, lots of different effects. But the easiest way to summarize them is just to think of probiotics as immune regulators, whereas they don't really impact the quantity and composition of the gut flora over time so much. On the other hand, prebiotics or fermentable fibers can significantly increase the quantity of beneficial species of bacteria, particularly bifidobacteria, which is one of the most important species in the colon. So prebiotics are arguably more important for restoring beneficial gut flora over time than probiotics. And whether you get them from food or whether you do things like eating resistant starch, which has been a big topic of discussion recently, and this is why. So like potato starch or potatoes that have been cooked or cooled, or green banana flour. Some people are using green plantain flour, green plantain, dehydrated green plantains, etc. Those are all perfectly valid and important strategies for improving the gut flora, and as I said, arguably more important than probiotics themselves. But I do think you should try to do both and just go slowly as possible and try different probiotics if you're still reacting to some.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating to think that you might have to look at the FODMAP list as foods to focus on eating, but might be a good thing, except for the sugars anyways.
Yeah, and sometimes for people with FODMAP issues, that's where I think something like potato starch can be helpful, because it can be more difficult to finely control the amount of FODMAP or resistant starch you're getting from foods. It's easier to do that with a supplement like a powder, whether it's like a prebiotic powder or like a resistant potato starch, where you can really finely measure out the dose each day that you're getting. And then, you know, over time, you want to just include as much fermentable fiber in the foods that you eat as possible. But initially, it might be easier to do with the supplements than the food.
Awesome. Well, awesome, Chris. As you mentioned earlier in the show, you've been doing a lot of searching and a lot of visioning, kind of seeing where Revolution Health Radio is going to go. And the listeners, you guys have the ability to have a lot of input here. So please make your desires known, whether it's on his Facebook feed, through the podcast submission link, or even in the actual this podcast on his blog. So put in the comments. Tell us what you want. Tell us what you want to hear, you know, throughout the rest of 2014 and beyond. And we'll make it happen, hopefully.
Yeah, we'll certainly consider it. And it's going to, I want, you know, this show is for you. It's for all of you listeners. And so I want to make it as relevant to you, to what you need as possible. And yeah, so it'd be really valuable to hear your feedback. Appreciate that.
Yeah, we're not going to start doing 3-hour shows after talking about digital detox, but maybe everything else is in bounds.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to hear your thoughts, whatever they are.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for another informative podcast, Chris. And thanks everyone for listening. As I mentioned earlier in the show, you can go to facebook.com/ChrisKresser LAC or twitter.com/ChrisKresser. Chris posts a lot of research throughout the week, a lot of articles that maybe you didn't get delivered to your inbox. So definitely check them out in those areas. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you on the next show.